The first movement we'll look at is the SNCC, the Students' Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. In October of the same year as the Greensboro sit-in, 1960, 235 students met down in Atlanta, Georgia, to found the SNCC, SNCC. Later, they were described as rather square reformers. And they certainly showed a gentleness, an unashamed Christian commitment, and an obvious middle ground class background. And they even had an appeal to the Bible and the Bill of Rights in their speaking. And their founding manifesto strongly affirmed belief in what they said was nonviolence as it grows out of the Judeo-Christian tradition. This is 1960. By 62 and 63, their members were returning from the South. And some had been beaten, and some whipped, and some shot, and some killed. And not surprisingly, they showed a new toughness that had been through the fires. But unfortunately, the bitterness was beginning to tarnish the bravery. One of the few who came through without bitterness, but only incredible bravery and intense human compassion, was Bob Parris. Returning from the heart of Mississippi, he could only say, "When you're in Mississippi, the rest of America just doesn't seem real. And when you're in the rest of America, Mississippi doesn't seem real." By itself, it sounds like a line from Peter Fonda. But the courageous dedication of the Freedom Riders of this time was a long way from the corny drivel of Easy Rider. It was no wonder that such selfless heroism won for Parris a legendary niche in the New Left. For many of the others, however, the bitterness was inevitably ousting the bravery. The fight against segregation was becoming a total fight against the system, but the word fight was still only metaphorical. The turning point here came in 66 at the annual conference in Nashville, Tennessee. When they met, Malcolm X had been assassinated, Julian Bond had been denied his rightful seat in the legislature, and the killers of Goodman, Charney, and Schwerner, lynched and murdered in 64, were still free. And they met in an atmosphere that was ugly with frustration and desperate for revolution. And as they did so, the gentle religious John Lewis was elected chairman first. But as the conference went on, the debates drained the spirit of bitterness to the dregs. And suddenly, Lewis was ousted and opposed. And in his place was installed the 25-year-old Stokely Carmichael. At one stroke, the SNCC of Camus and Baldwin gave way to the SNCC of Carmichael and Franz Fanon. Nonviolence gave way to violence. Cooperation gave way to separatism. Civil rights to black nationalism. One more polarization had been born. From then on, they scorned the loss of the shield of liberal approval and scorned the cooperation of the white radicals. And Black Power and later the Black Panthers had set out on their long, lonely road. The second organization we'll look at is the SDS. We're just looking at highlights which make them important. Equally typical and equally important is the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. Together with SNCC, the two formed the most influential early groups in the New Left. And like SNCC, the SDS was a direct result of 1960. It grew out of the old League for Industrial Democracy, which had been founded by Jack London. And this year, they rechristened their youth department the SDS. But when they did so, they couldn't hold a convention because there were so few members. But then in 61 of December, 35 students met together to set up an executive council and plan a convention for 62. And to plan this, they commissioned Tom Hayden, a young radical from the University of Michigan, to write a manifesto. The convention was held in June 62 at Port Huron, with only 59 people present, and it was here that the SDS was launched. Two features make the SDS particularly representative and important for our purposes. The first is its history, because its history is a plunging graph of increasing radicalization. Originally, the SDS was a liberal-left coalition with a multi-issue perspective and a humane, if a somewhat verbose, manifesto. Probably not one of us would disagree with many of the central statements of their manifesto. For example, the statement, "We regard men as infinitely precious and possessed of unfulfilled capacities for reason, freedom, and love. We oppose the depersonalization that reduces human beings to the status of things. Loneliness, estrangement, isolation describe the vast distance between man and man today. And these dominant tendencies cannot be overcome by better personnel management, nor by improved gadgets, but only when a love of man for man overcomes the idolatrous worship of things by man. Who disagree with statements like this? The manifesto also introduced the famous concept of participatory democracy. And typical of their earlier slogans was build, not burn. Pragmatism, however, has an uncanny way of toying with the loftiest of principles. The SDS very soon fell out with the League for Industrial Democracy over their refusal to be anti-communist. And they were locked out of their offices by the parent organization. In the election of 64, though, they were still wearing the button part of the way with LBJ. And you can imagine that would be unthinkable for anyone in the SDS in the years after that. Because the years after that show the drastic shift in their loyalties. And now they're characterized by total radicalism and a complete non-cooperative despair about the system. You can see this very well expressed in Tom Hayden's open letter to the McCarthyites, which comes in the SDS magazine at the time of the Chicago Convention. Hayden writes, "In the beginning, back in the heroic struggle of the civil rights period, say 60 to 64, our assumptions were barely radical at all. Black people should be free. Nothing very extreme about that. Isn't that the cardinal promise of our country's official morality? Our demands could not have been simpler. Live up to these promises, America. And somehow we assume that somewhere in its mysterious heart, America really wanted to do just that. But you know the end of that particular story. Heartbreak and terror." In 63, the SDS were the first to copy SNCC in beginning community organization in the ghettos. In 65, they were the first to organize against the draft. You remember that some 20,000 came to the Washington Peace March in April. And the group included Berkeley free speech veterans, Mississippi freedom riders, disillusioned Peace Corps volunteers, and SDS-tutored black teenagers from the ghettos. Typical of the way they were beginning to spearhead the whole movement. Within 8 weeks of the march, they'd been manhandled by the media, photographed, publicized, popularized, psychoanalyzed, almost everything but understood. In October, they were credited with calling out 80,000 marchers in various cities around the states. And by then, the SDS could justly claim to be the spearhead of a new left. But all the time, they were heading down a very narrow road of radicalization. For the movement generally, there was the increasing trend from frustration towards despair. For many of the individuals, too, there was usually some radical baptism, some moment of truth. The shared danger for the sake of justice was the sacramental baptism of fire. For some, it was Mississippi 64. For some, Chicago 68. For some, Attica 71, etc., etc. But for each, there was a point of no return. From then on, there could only be the great refusal. This is the first interesting thing. From their early ideals, they'd come around to this hardline despair, because of their experience of the intransigence of the state. The second representative feature was their structure. An obvious mark of the SDS was its unusually ecumenical combination of widely diverse groups, which at other times have been murderous rivals. The SDS somehow managed to include anarchists, Marxists, socialists, pacifists, humanists, bohemians, and even mystics, and managed to hold them together in their autonomous free-form chapters. There was never any single national leader, only a council of 35. And this was both a feature of the SDS strength as well as a point of weakness. As a strength, it had the advantage of creating an effective striking force. By comparison with the elephantine machinery of the Young Republicans and the Young Democrats, the SDS were a tiny minority, but highly vocal and extremely mobile. Just 200 militants at Columbia could cripple a university of over 17,000. Sometimes their tactics are blatantly obvious, as at Columbia. Sometimes they are more subtle, as at some of the incidents in Antioch. But their formation with these loose, free-form chapters was tactically ideal. Basically, the tactics could be summarized in three words: confrontation, polarization, revolution. And that was their basic scenario of revolution. With such goals, no radical leader ever hoped to succeed by attracting converts. Rather, he attracted converts by making sure that he succeeded. If this is their advantage, of course, it was also their disadvantage. Because these same autonomous free-form groups tended towards dissipation, if not disintegration. There was never any centrally controlled directive, no universal accepted theory, no definitely organized contingency planning. They had a fear of doctrinaire theory, which was natural. And they had a fear of dictatorial leadership. But this became almost a subtle dogma in itself, and frequently it led them to appalling anti-intellectualism and romanticism and disorganization. For example, Tom Hayden openly argued, "We should rely more on feel than on theory. We start out armed only with questions, believing that the answers can be discovered in action." But there's always a connection between such romanticism and eventual totalitarianism, and the later SDS is no exception. It resulted often in wanton destruction. Ironically, it was in the very name of academic freedom that eventually they destroyed research files and burned PhD theses, openly repudiating the entire history of Western freedom in academic circles. Worse still, there was an increasing denial of free speech. Berkeley 64 had focused on free speech, but by 68, Marcuse was speaking of discriminating intolerance and calling for an elite and not allowing the other side to speak. Marcuse inquired rhetorically, "Is there now any alternative other than the dictatorship of an elite over the people? Only partisan obstinacy can fail to see the extreme dialectical somersault in this doctrinaire denial of free speech which they'd originally set out to stand for." There was also the dangerous espousal of violence. Isn't it surprising now, just as late as 66, people like Jack Newfield, who's a radical himself, were citing non-violence as a defining feature of the New Left. Using this feature, in fact, he excluded various parties like the PLP and Black Power as dangerous because of their violence. Even as late as 68, in the spring of 68, Kenneth Keniston, who's very perceptive in his analysis, claimed that the general trends of the counterculture were definitely non-violent. But by May, such claims had been relegated to history. The tenuous grasp on the principle of non-violence had been shattered by the intractable response of the power elite and the overreaction of the police. And now they took to violence in a very real way. Graduating Realpolitik from Regis Debray's statement, "To show force is in effect to use it," they went on to Mao Zedong's statement, "Power grows out of the barrel of the gun." But what was clear was that violence was paying. And in an atmosphere where violence was paying, pragmatism was much more productive than principle. Thus, with only relativism or dialectics underlying modern principles, no about-face is unthinkable. No moral somersault is now impossible. What is anathema one year can easily be a firm conviction the next year. This is what we really need to see. We must not be surprised when they do any amount of about turns with complete volte-faces, because there's no absolutes underneath it, and there's only pragmatism behind it. One of the SDS presidents, Carl Oglesby, had written earlier, "We want to create a world in which love is more possible." But by 68, he was saying, "Revolutions do not take place in velvet boxes. Nuns will have to be raped, and bureaucrats will have to be disemboweled." What had happened in between was that principles had founders, the revolution itself had been an aid in absolute, and change was pursued for change's sake, and naturally this steamrolled over the earlier human values. Not surprisingly, the Port Huron statement is no longer official policy. Now, just because of lack of space and time, we won't go into many of the other groups and events and leaders, even though many of them deserve treatment. For example, I'm missing out many important things like the Berkeley's free speech movement, the May Revolution 68, the Chicago Convention, M-Day 61, Kent State Shooting 70, etc., etc. And we have to look into many other groups, such as the Russian Marxist groups, the Yippies, the Weathermen, Women's Lib, and so on. And if we looked at some of the leading personalities, we'd have to look at closely at Dave Dillinger and Tom Hayden and Bobby Seale. Over in Europe, Alan Geismar, Danny Cohn-Bendit, Rudi Deutschke, and so on. But we'll miss them out. Let me go on next to the failure of the New Left. Beyond the details of these various groups, the question inevitably arises, where are we now? What is it that really explains what President Kingman Brewster of Yale has called the eerie tranquility of the last year or two? Or what Time magazine described as the cooling of America? Where are we now? Are we really witnessing Reich's greening of America? Is violence really reverting to nonviolence as a deeper revolution in men's minds is making a revolution on the streets simplistic and superfluous? Or, in fact, are we slowly facing up to a higher level of frustration and the unwelcome reality of the abortion of the counterculture? Or is this merely just a period of retrenchment and rethinking? I think two factors falsify any optimism on behalf of the counterculture. The first is the fact that up to where we are now, the new left has failed. And the second is the fact that they've not only failed, they've managed to bring down around their necks a heightened repression even stronger than that which they faced before. These are the two factors we'll look into. The first is the new left's substantial failure to achieve its goals. Plainly, no system in any advanced industrial society has so far been overthrown. But it'd be wrong not to appreciate the influence that each national revolutionary movement has had. In mainland China, for example, the Red Guards proved almost too explosive for their masters. In Spain, the students have been the most successful of all the students in Europe and America in cooperating closely with the working classes. In Germany, the radicals temporarily had the distinction of almost usurping the credible left-wing stance. In France, the students were unique in the West for bringing a government to its knees, even if only for a few days, and if most surprising to themselves. And in the United States, the overall failure of the radicals has not prevented the acceptance of many of their ideas. The realization in the States today, for instance, that war is no longer glorious, that pollution is an urgent problem, that the American dream stands a long way from fulfillment, that the human race is profoundly in trouble. These are insights that are now widely shared on all sides and quite outside the radius of the radicals. Also, it's true that in the beat of their music and the style of their clothes and their dedication to drugs, the lifestyle of a movement has become the image of an entire generation. Nevertheless, most of society has remained relatively unchanged, and most of the visible change has been in the radicals themselves, and its terminus has been despair. What are some of the reasons for this failure? Undoubtedly, the first and central weakness has been the insufficiency of the radicals' program. Both the alternative they offer to modern technology and the means they employ to achieve their end are quite inadequate. This has meant that their critique of technology is both their sharpest insight and their most stubborn failure. And I think this deserves a whole treatment by itself, and that's what the lecture this afternoon will be on, critique of technology. Passing over this central weakness, however, we can mention other lesser factors. One is the conspicuous absence of several of the celebrated prerequisites of previous revolutions. There are various things that you've seen always in the great revolutions, such as the French and Russian and so on. For example, no drastic economic crisis has brought any Western country to its knees, although there have been recessions. No devastating military disaster or extreme national humiliation has profoundly shaken a country, although Vietnam has come as near to that as anything. No government has seen a mass defection of intellectuals, as happened in France in 1789 or Russia in 1917. In fact, general unrest is hardly the order of the day, and genuine revolutionary attitudes are limited to comparatively small pockets, and the gap between revolution and reality is only covered and disguised by rhetoric. A second factor is the social isolation of the student activists. Their vision of being catalysts to reawaken the proletariat and unite it with the Third World has been a stark fiasco. Their true relation to the Third World was more in the order of revolutionary myths and symbols than practical reality. Often they got no closer than pinning Che Guevara's poster to their walls. Their relation to the working class was, if anything, even more distant, although closer geographically. Admittedly, not every movement suffered the indignity of the American radicals when the so-called workers actually marched against them. But generally speaking, the masses were unmoved, and the middle-class origins of the students have been cruelly exposed. Only the Spanish students persistently, and the French students for a fleeting moment, ever achieved a real alliance with the workers. The Great Paris Workers' March on May 13, 68 was almost unique. You remember Danny Cohn-Bendit was at the front, And the students, with the spearhead of the march, followed secondly by the trade union leaders, with all the left-wing official politicians like François Mitterrand marching humbly at the rear. But it was very, very easy for President de Gaulle to come back and divorce the students from the workers and exploit the situation to his own advantage. The reason is, as Herbert Marcuse has admitted on television in Britain, the students at best can only be called catalysts, and a real revolution is unimaginable without the reaction of the masses. This they've never had, they just haven't been close enough. A third factor for their failure is their heavy reliance on anarchism. Although understandable as a reaction, in other words, against dogmatic Marxism, the stress on ethics rather than economics, the stress on alienation as opposed to exploitation, only led to a soft left. Anarchism has always shown two weaknesses inherent in its principles. It has never had sufficient force to seize power, nor sufficient form to retain power. And the history of anarchism is a series of lessons in a lost cause. They've never won a revolution. Again, I'll go into that more this afternoon. But the new left reliance on anarchism was no better than leaning on a broken reed. A fourth factor has been their susceptibility to the mass media. And we should see now that this has really happened several times. Oscar Wilde joked in the last century, "In the United States, the president rules for 4 years, and journalism governs forever." The force of this comment in a day prior to television is now sharpened by the abdication of truth for image. The loss of democracy in a day of consensus politics has been a constant cry of the radicals, but ironically, they themselves superbly illustrate the Midas touch of the media, as we've seen. What is marketable by the media is manipulable by the system, and therefore contained. Jack Newfield complains that to be a radical in America today is like trying to punch your way out of a cage made of marshmallow. Every thrust of the jugular at the jugular draws not blood, but sweet success. For instance, the anger of Leroy Jones, now with his Muslim name, or Norman Mailer, sounds a little forced after their television fees or their million-dollar book royalties. If Haight-Ashbury was blown up by the media in one sense, in other words, it was inflated into a myth, it was also the media which caused the explosion into reality. It was blown up in another sense. Woodstock and the Peace Marches are examples of other things that have suffered the identical fate, and so has the Jesus movement, which is why so many Christians are stupid and foolish when they're constantly, out of their insecurity, desperate to make their big time and hit the media. Recently, Abby Hoffman has restyled his own image to more clean-cut lines. He complained, "Every time I turn on the television, I see another movie star with long hair. The counterculture has been co-opted by Warner Brothers." These are just a few of the reasons for the failure of the new left, but as I say, the most important one is their failure to come to terms with technology, which we'll look at this afternoon. Because of this, what we are seeing today is the occasion of a general parting of the movement. And this is what we'll look into next, the parting of the waves. In the increasing diversification, the outline of several specific trends is becoming clearer, and these may well provide the direction for the next few years. The first trend, among those still committed to activism, is a resort to increased violence. An obvious expression of terminal frustration, its mark is the perpetration of more violence, but by fewer people. As such, it closely parallels the period in the last century when anarchists used the slogan, "propaganda by the deed." Following a time of general failure in the last century, what they did was to take to extreme violence as a revolutionary statement against symbols of the establishment, such as blowing up buildings or assassinating its leaders. And incidentally, it was in this period that the image of the quintessential anarchist was born. You know, the image of the anarchist with the sinister, slouching figure, with his hat pulled down over his eyes, with a smoking bomb in one pocket and a home chemistry manual sticking out of the other one. This was the anarchist of this time. Romantic at a distance, he was vicious, destructive, and nihilist in practice. But this has been duplicated today in the SDS split, particularly in the emergence of the Weatherman faction. And it's exemplified in the bombing of the Wisconsin Math Center. Earlier, they scorn nonviolence today as the Parsons mode of thought, which Lenin called it. And these sort of people are in danger of becoming an underground collective of grimly moralistic Bonnies and Clydes, self-brutalizing in their pretentious principles and counterproductive in their methods. Obviously, this is a heyday, too, for hijacking. The people who are making their supreme statement of personality, like the fellow who shot Wallace, and so on. We're going to see a heyday of individual violence, more violence, but by fewer people. I'm not saying all of it's political, a lot of it's psychological, but the Weatherman faction is definitely political. A second general trend is towards a new line Marxism that's closer to Mao. If the softer left, or Salon communism, was too weak, then there must be a return to the later Marx, who had coldly defined theories and brutally efficient tactics. It's time to take Che Guevara off the walls and study the dialectical principles that might turn him loose in the streets. This has meant a more critical analysis of recent activism. Looking back now, we can see the new left was correct in recognizing that Marx's analysis had run aground on the realities of the post-war world. Of all people, the labor unions, far from being revolutionary, were the ones who needed to be radicalized. The new left saw this rightly. The recognition that there was a new stage, that Marx was outdated, was what gave rise to the new left. And the whole period of the marches in the South, which grew into the movement, was their answer. Their answer, in other words, was to do what any decent human being could do, put his own body down the line. In the beginning, it was sensitive and understandable. But as time went on, it was obviously not enough in itself. Eventually, the rise of the Weathermen warned of the logic of this irrational, self-frustrating romanticism. Now we've got the new stage. The new stage is to turn from such counterproductive conclusions and to strike a new stance, this time as worker theorists, appealing not primarily to Marx, but to Mao as the model. And the new ideal is the Maoist intellectual, a man engaged simultaneously in rigorous theoretical discussion and practical floor-level responsibilities. So the new ideal is the worker theorist activist. And you can see this called for in such people as Staunton Lind and so on. The need for this is obviously more obvious in the States than in Europe. For European radicals have always prided themselves on their disciplined grasp of theory, which the American radicals have matched only in their compensating dedication and large-hearted idealism. European radicals have always been much more theoretical, dogmatic, down to earth. It's interesting, incidentally, that many now seem to be returning to Berkeley, especially, almost mystically hoping, for instance, Hayden's back there and many of the others, almost mystically hoping that the revolutionary phoenix is going to rise again from Sproul Plaza. The third general trend is toward completely apolitical areas of involvement. This stems from the failure of political activism and is a return to a climate similar to the romanticism of Haight-Ashbury, but now lent Ivy League respectability by Charles Reich Greening of America. Interesting that with Reich, as well as Eric Siegel's love story, Yale is playing a very leading role in a momentary swing back to romanticism. What Consciousness 3 does is salvage the movement's nonviolence and directs it towards a new psychic orientation, combining it with the impulse towards withdrawal that's already inherent in drugs and Eastern mysticism. The parting of the ways between activism and mysticism is highlighted in the argument between Norman O'Brown and Herbert Marcuse as to the real focus of revolutionary activity. Norman O'Brown says the real revolution is internal. Marcuse says that it's external. There's a brilliant article, incidentally, on Reich recently in commentary by Samuel McCracken. He said this. In other words, Reich speaking about the internal revolution. Kraken says, Reich is the most profoundly counter-revolutionary author of our day. For nothing can be calculated more effectively to dampen true revolutionary ardor than the argument that the Bastille will crumble if we will only sit down outside it and groove for a while. In other words, for committed activists, Consciousness 3 is the betrayal of serious revolution. In England, Jeff Nuttall writes, it's now necessary to come back from this dangerous talk of inner space. If we cannot translate the spiritual in terms of the constructive physical, then the spiritual is none of our damn business. The English scene getting frightened of the new internal revolution. But for the people to whom Reich is speaking, the smarting lessons of political failure points in an opposite direction. You see, there's no resolution between this polarization, political revolution which achieves too much, or the internal revolution which achieves nothing. A fourth general trend is the accelerating swing towards the new communities. Along with the community projects within the cities, these communes, where they're not merely escapist, often demonstrate the remaining idealism and integrity of our generation at its highest. At its best, this is not the world of a dropout, but a high and sensitive view of freedom, nature, land, and soil, in an environment untainted by technological imperative. Growing one's own food, making one's own clothes, educating one's own children. This is a real return to simplicity and freedom, and it's a natural goal in a world where there are no more frontiers to the West. Incidentally, I think perhaps one of the best answers to technology, on the basic level of all, in other words, not in terms of fight, is for the Christian to really rediscover what it means to live simply. If you read the Sermon on the Mount carefully, you realize we've succumbed to a world of materialism and waste. And maybe that's where the fight's got to begin, not in high-sounding phrases, but on really living simply with our clothes, our belongings, our goals, and genuinely practicing the simplicity of the Christian life. Sadly, this is not the total picture of the commune situation. For every successful commune, there are several more reluctantly forced to see the barrenness of their basis for a human community. How does one really achieve a community with unity and diversity, with an authority that gives a genuine form but does not stifle freedom, and with a way that points to being able to settle differences and heal alienations? For instance, you can't live in a community very long without discovering in a community it's not what someone does which bugs you, it's what someone doesn't do that really bugs you. And living in a community where you're very, very close is very, very different to living in a city situation where if you don't like a person, just drop out of their orbit. To found a community or a commune on escapism is obviously to court disaster. But to build a community only on idealism is little better in the long run. And many of the intentional communes, which have based themselves on the ideal of total freedom, have failed within the first year. And the sad dilemma that they've faced is pinpointed in a poignant letter written to the modern utopians. You can find this in the Whole Earth catalog. Here's a guy writing who's been in communes for 30 years trying to find the ideal one. And this is what he writes at the end of it. If the intentional community hopes to survive, it must be authoritarian. And if it's authoritarian, offers no more freedom than conventional society. I'm not pleased with this conclusion, but it now seems to me that the only way to be free is to live entirely alone. In other words, you reject conventional society for total freedom, but you find total freedom leads to chaos, so you have to set up a new authority, maybe a charismatic figure who runs the community, maybe a religious system, Buddhism or whatever, but you've imposed some new structure and you've eventually lost the freedom. So it goes to another one, but the cycle goes on. And there's no resolution to the dualism between form and freedom. This is really only a cultural footnote on Nietzsche's prophetic insight that in a world without God, there's never resolution between form and freedom. And to a generation tending to opt universally for freedom without form, a letter like this should stand as an epitaph to past efforts and a warning to future efforts. A fifth general trend, which is not specifically out of the failure of the counterculture, but which has been made more important because of it, and certainly one that would deserve closer attention, is the phenomena of the rock festivals. This is far more important than a passing fashion or a style of music, because the festivals uniquely express a generation's utopian wistfulness. It all began back in Monterey, 67, with Eric Burdon, Janis Joplin, The Who, Ravi Shankar, Otis Redding, and Simon and Garfunkel. And after three days, even the police were wearing flowers, and those who were not high on grass and acid were high on idealism. This is the beginning. Woodstock, August 69, was the orgasmic climax of love, peace, and music, hailed at the time as an important landmark in the awakening of the collective unconsciousness. It was later blown up to mythical cosmic proportions by the film, which broke down distinctions between those who were originally there and those who weren't, and made everyone who saw it true participants. To the press, incidentally, at once, we were the Woodstock generation. But then came Altamont, 1970, and the explosion into reality. The summer of terminal euphoria all over again, with thefts, burnings, delays, violence, and cancellations. Transcendent togetherness was the peak. And that was how Newsweek described Woodstock. Then the end was Gimme Shelter, the filmed record of Altamont of the Rolling Stones, the cry at the end of the line. As the Isle of Wight Festival began in 1970, the DJ got up and said, "A great spiritual awakening is breaking out," and all 300,000 people were invited to join hands every morning. Peace signs waved and so on. Bob Dylan should have been invited to return to the second summer and sing "When Will They Ever Learn?" 3 days later, violence is erupting. The same DJ was cursing people. Smoke bombs were drifting across the stage, and that was how it ended. 3 weeks later, the trio of the original Monterey Stars were dead, all because of drugs under tragic circumstances. I wonder if any of us will ever forget the pathos of the closing scenes of Woodstock. The debris-strewn garbage apocalypse and the haunting improvisations of Jimi Hendrix left by himself on the stage. Hendrix said just before he died, "People think I'm free. Actually, I just have to keep on running." Joni Mitchell notwithstanding, the bombers were still bombers, and the butterflies were rarely to be seen, and the children of God were no nearer to the garden. This is the children of God before the recent children of God. "I had a dream," sang Sebastian, but that was as far as it went. Such dreams never troubled reality. Eric Clapton was much closer to the truth when he pointed out in an interview at the end of that year, "Their deaths were almost necessary sacrifices." In other words, because of the romanticism of the generation, these people died. "It'll be a long time," Clapton said, "before I shall feel at peace again. I just wish 1970 would hurry up and go away. It's all been a disaster." Fits in very well with the seminar history. A sixth trend is the quiet compromise of principle and the capitulation of action that leads so many radicals straight back to bourgeois normalcy. For any genuine radical, it must be alarming that such a high proportion complete the cycle from idealism to frustration to despair to apathy and arrive back again at their point of departure. One wonders how many of today's radicals will be tomorrow's bourgeois. Incidentally, this is always a problem in the pop world, with such a stress on ephemeral images and the induced transience of success. Once you succeed at the age of 18, 19, 20, what do you aspire to during the next 50 years of your life? In other words, for these radicals, if there's no radix or root for their truth, then they're caught in a relativistic vacuum, and eventually they go around the whole cycle. A good example of this is the career of the public image of John Osborne. In the mid-50s, John Osborne was the angry young man. In 1961, he wrote to the London paper, The Tribune, and caustically said, "This is a letter of hate. It's for you, my countrymen. Damn you, England. You're rotting now, and quite soon you'll disappear." That was 61, angry young man. But by 64, his new play, Inadmissible Evidence, he introduces a solicitor, Bill Maitland. And you have there an older, more disillusioned Jimmy Porter. And Maitland now attacks not the establishment only, but the youth of his day. He describes them as all cool, young, dreamy, forthright, contemptuous, unimpressed. 5 years later, by 69, Osborne has found himself accused of being right-wing, upper class. He now lives in a very expensive Chelsea home. And now he even admits his gratitude at being English rather than Russian or American. And in a very famous TV interview, he said, "Nowadays, my instinct is to lower the temperature rather than raise it." Seen from a radical viewpoint, this is betrayal. Seen from another viewpoint, it's perhaps just an acute insight into where contemporary reality lies. This compromise of principle and return to bourgeois morality is one cause of the present vacuum. So here's the first general point. Where are we now? There's a failure, and these are some of the causes, and those are some of the parting of the ways we're seeing. Now the last point, just in the last few minutes. The second cause is the ominous suspicion that all unsuccessful activism only hastens the very danger it seeks to overcome, the possibility of increased repression. Here you see the cruel irony of the Great Refusal. Having correctly diagnosed the dehumanizing trends in industrial society, the radicals concluded their analysis so hastily that they failed to see the roots of the problem. Building a revolution on insufficient base, they were inevitably condemned to failure. The betrayal of their idealism and their own pragmatic use of violence has only served to accelerate the very forces they were out to combat. Of course, it would be a reactionary folly to blame the new left for recent repression. But it would be equally not wrong not to see that they have contributed to the repression. The principle holds good for society as well as communes. With no basis for form and freedom in the post-Christian democracies, the swing towards authoritarian control may be undesirable, but the alternative swing towards anarchic chaos is unthinkable by government standards. Recognizing this, one of the French politicians in 68 in May went through the Latin Quarter of Paris, wringing his hands as he watched the riots, screaming at the people with tears to stop, shouting out, "Every fire you light in the streets is one more vote for General de Gaulle." As it happened, the overwhelming Gaullist majority in the following election proved his point brilliantly. An overassertion towards the freedom and chaos which it looks to the left is always countered by a swing towards the right. The American radicals are learning the same hard lesson. No one should be deceived about the law and order issue. This is no longer an objective law whose form guarantees and preserves freedom. The search now is for a law, in the sense of a pragmatic prohibition, strong enough to curb disorder. No longer is it right that gives might, but might that makes right on either side. Truth is the majority law of that group which overpowers all others. The backlash tendency in recent elections is obvious evidence of all this. John Mitchell, remember, was reported recently a couple of years ago saying, "This country is going so far right, you're not even going to recognize it." Speaking from Britain, Peter Buckman, who is a radical examining the failure of protest, said, "Not to over-dramatize it, it's possible the failures of neo-capitalism will be succeeded by a form of neo-fascism." That's a bit over extreme, but undoubtedly they brought down greater strength on their heads, and society is even stronger now as a system than when they first fought it. One last descriptive footnote to the present vacuum. It's curious that as the coherence of the counterculture is increasingly lacking credibility, so the surveys and overviews of the counterculture grow proportionately more unrealistic and romantically optimistic. An early one, like Jack Newfield's A Prophetic Minority, written in 66, is filled with a surging idealism and catches well the early bravery, but it's realistic. Rorschach's The Making of the Counterculture, written in 69, gives an incisive critique of technology and a perceptive profile of the movement, but when you come down to his own basis for a solution, it just runs out in mysticism. When you come down to 1970 with Charles Reif Greene of America, instantly a bestseller, you have a book whose positive solution can only be described as wistfulness incarnate. And remembering Jean-François Revel's book last year, Neither Marx Nor Jesus, you see a man who says that we're actually succeeding in the revolution, at the very point when most of the revolutionaries feel that they've failed. In other words, it's interesting again, the romanticism inherent in our generation. The bestseller lists reflect campus aspirations far more than campus reality or revolution reality. The almost universal sense of failure and the heightening fear of repression tell a different story. The great refusal has unwittingly become the great betrayal. But obviously this should not drive us to defeatism or despair. It should challenge us to a more exacting critique of why they went wrong. In other words, this is where I think those of us are Christians. We must avoid this almost mystical identification with our generation. On the one hand, it's good. On the other hand, it's lazy and romantic. Far too many young people just go along with the tides and with their peer groups easily. And if our generation's radical or follows drugs or in this movement or that, we follow along and baptize it in Christian terminology. I think we've got to have the guts to say no to all that which is wrong on the adult side. But then have the even stronger guts to look at our generation's attempt at a counterculture and say the great refusal is itself no good, and we must have an even greater refusal.